Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to talk about the period of British politics around 1916, when halfway through the First World War, Herbert Asquith is replaced by David Lloyd George with the kind of the assistance and connivance of Winston Churchill. And really, what's going on at that time? Why does Britain have this kind of change of leadership halfway through the war? I guess it's kind of topical at the moment in Great Britain, particularly as we are almost expecting prime ministers now to last a matter of months, in some cases obviously weeks. But the thing about Asquith is that he'd been in power for approximately 10 years at this point as Prime Minister, overcoming enormous constitutional crises with the House of Lords and the People's Budget, and managing to steer through some of the most successful social reforms of the era. Match, you know, almost sort of rivaling the post Second World War Labour government. So he wasn't this sort of kind of rootless incompetent that we've been cursed with recently. In fact, far from it. He is this kind of titan of liberal politics. However, the First World War seems to change all that. So we're looking at an excellent biography of Winston Churchill. This is a kind of not so much a biography as a kind of a critical reading of the cult of Churchill, which seems to kind of grip the nation. And it's Geoffrey Wheatcroft's book, Churchill's Shadow, An Astonishing Life and a Dangerous Legacy. And so here is where we begin. Geoffrey Wheatcroft writes, "By December 1916, discontent with Asquith's inert conduct of the war allowed Lloyd George to outplay him and replace him as Prime Minister, with the support of press magnates, notably Lord Northcliffe, and Max Aitken, who would be rewarded for the following year by being made Lord Beaverbrook. Beaverbrook, of course, is a lifelong friend of Churchill's, became Churchill's Minister of Aircraft Supply in 1940. It's really interesting to observe, over a century ago, still the importance and the significance and the political power of press barons, and this has only kind of accentuated here in the 21st century, as we are seem to be a kind of a quasi democracy run by media magnates. Anyway, Lloyd George wanted to bring Churchill back into government, partly because he needed his dynamism, partly from a flicker of guilt to the limited extent that Lloyd George ever felt that after abandoning him. Obviously, after the failure of Gallipoli, Churchill as First Lord of the Admiralty was hung out to dry. It wasn't all his fault, but he certainly wasn't blameless either. And partly on the principle later expressed with Texan bluntness by Lyndon Johnson: with a certain kind of man, you'd rather have him on the inside pissing out than on the outside pissing in. When Lloyd George made just that point, in Welsh Baptist rather than Texan, to Andrew Bonar Law, would it not be better to have Churchill with us than against us? Bonar Law replied, I'd rather have him against us every time. So again, I mean, Churchill, who had crossed benches, who had been a conservative, then a liberal, and then would switch back to the Conservative Party later on, throughout most of his career, was widely mistrusted, seen as a sort of unreliable, unpredictable, and untrustworthy political ally. I mean, I suppose part of the kind of the part of the way in which, for example, the likes of Boris Johnson have modelled themselves on Winston Churchill in recent years, which, I mean, he hasn't really, he likes to kind of cite Churchill as a reference point, but doesn't everybody. Was to look at Churchill's personal failings and the fact that Churchill was able to kind of politically triumph from the end in spite of his personal failings. I suppose if you are kind of someone who accumulates personal and political failings like parking tickets, then this is a kind of an attractive fantasy to buy into. Now the dissonance was louder than ever between Churchill's indomitable self-belief and the sheer dislike and distrust he inspired. By his early 40s, he'd acquired two reputations: as a reckless and unstable adventurer, and as an unprincipled, self-seeking opportunist. These are more striking because they would seem to be mutually exclusive, but they help to explain why, for a man of his fame and his gifts, Churchill enjoyed so little political support. His Tory foes at the time conceded his courage, energy and brilliance, Lloyd George much later wrote, but they asked why, in spite of all that, although he had many admirers, he had fewer followers than any prominent man in Britain. Churchill had never attracted, and had never certainly retained, the affection of any section, province or town, and he was, and the answer was not far to seek, Lloyd George thought. His mind was a powerful machine, but there lay hidden in its material or makeup some obscure defect which prevented it from always running true. Given that Churchill's tendency to think in terms of race, it's ironic that there were some, including Asquith, who wondered whether that erratic temperament came from Mexican or indigenous American blood on his mother's side. But Asquith's wife, Margot, saw more clearly. That silly, snobbish but clever woman liked Churchill, but apart from thinking that his vanity is septic, she mused about what gives Winston his preeminence. It is certainly not his mind. I said long ago, and with truth, Winston has a very noisy mind. Certainly not his judgment. He is constantly very wrong indeed. And of course it is his courage and his colour, his amazing mixture of industry and enterprise. Poor Winston, his political position is nil. So here you have somebody who is a strange mixture of ambition and an ability to betray others, and an ability to demonstrate appalling judgment. Later on, I mean, one of the great sort of failings of the movie The King's Speech is that it portrays Winston Churchill as the sort of the mentor to the kind of the John of Gaunt figure to George the Sixth, and in fact the opposite was true. Winston Churchill was renowned for coming into Parliament roaring drunk, demanding that there be a King's Party established during the abdication crisis of Edward VIII, and the King's Party's sole purpose would be to support Edward against the government. This was seen as catastrophically bad judgment, and it had very little to do with Edward's imagined Nazi sympathies. There were abundant fascist sympathies amongst Britain's upper class, as it wasn't a particularly novel position to take. What seemed to be the case is that Britain, in 1936, a largely socially conservative country, one where we've been through decades of royal scandals and divorces and things like that, but the idea of the king marrying an American divorcee was really, really quite shocking. This is a point at which the royal family in the interwar period still has to carry a significant amount of moral authority, significantly more than it needs to carry now. So that really is the essence of the divorce crisis, and Winston Churchill's kind of crass and poorly judged contribution to it certainly gained him no friends, and certainly in about the same era, his views on the future of India were, even to imperialists, wildly unrealistic. So Churchill has this track record for making the wrong calls, but he only had to make the right call once, which was, of course, in May 1940. So Geoffrey Wheatcroft writes about Churchill. All the same, through all his setbacks, Churchill never lost his reverence for constitutional parliamentary government. He briefed Alexander McCallum Scott, a backbench liberal, who had written a sympathetic biography of Churchill in 1905, when he was only 30. Scott recorded a moment he had shared with Churchill in March 1917. "As we are leaving the house late tonight," he called me back into the chamber to take a last look around. All was darkness except the ring of faint light around under the gallery. We could dimly see the table, but walls and roofs were invisible. "Look at it," he said. "This little place is what makes the difference between us and Germany. It is in virtue of this that we shall muddle through and to success, and for the lack of this, Germany's brilliant efficiency leads her to final disaster. This little room is a shrine of the world's liberties." Those were fine words, especially at a time when the little room wasn't listening to Churchill, writes Geoffrey Wheatcroft. He did return to the government in July 1917. But before then, the course of the war had changed dramatically. The February Revolution in Russia had overthrown the Tsar. A new democratic government was still committed to the war, but half-heartedly. And Russian people were even less enthusiastic. If Russia fell out of the war, the German army on the Western Front could be hugely reinforced from the East. But if Entente was going to lose one ally... If the Entente was going to lose one ally, I beg your pardon, another arrived. When the European War broke out in 1914, President Woodrow Wilson had been in the White House for only 17 months, which had been wholly preoccupied with domestic reform, and neither he nor the most Americans wanted to enter the distant conflict. A few Anglophile New England Republicans, like Wilson's great antagonist, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge from Massachusetts, favoured joining the British side, but they were in the small minority. In England particularly, Churchill would later obtusely write, where laws and language seemed to make a bridge of mutual comprehension between the two nations, no one could understand why American entry into the war took so long. He claimed, without evidence, that Wilson underestimated American feeling in favour of the Allies, and that what Wilson did by entering the war in April 1917 could have been done in May 1915. And if done then, what abridgment of the slaughter, what sparing of the agony, what ruin, what catastrophes would have been prevented? In how many million homes would an empty chair be occupied today? How different would be the shattered world in which victors and vanquished alike are condemned to live? So this is obviously, you know, Churchill's way of viewing the world and viewing the war. And Geoffrey Wheatcroft argues that this is kind of wholly unrealistic and a kind of a real misunderstanding of American politics and of America at the time. He writes, the country had been peopled by migrants escaping from Europe in its conflicts, notably from military conscription. Not only did most Americans want to keep out of the war when it began, good contemporary judges reckon that had the United States been obliged to take sides, then more Americans would have preferred to fight against the Anglo-Russian, the Anglo-French-Russian Entente than for it. Millions of Irish Americans had no wish to fight for the King of England. Millions of Jewish Americans had no wish to fight for the Tsars of Russia.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Whose oppression they had fled, and tens of millions of German Americans had no wish to fight against their ancestral homeland. Even Wilson himself worried when the fighting began that he might have to go to war against England. He identified with James Madison, the only other Princeton man to have reached the White House, and memories of the British blockade, which lay behind the 1812 war, made him think that another blockade, an essential part of British strategy against Germany now, as it had been once against France, might be the cause of war again. By May 1915, Churchill intended the sinking of the Lusitania, a liner carrying munitions as well as passengers, 1,959 passengers and crew aboard the ship drowned, and the dead included 128 Americans. A persistent conspiracy theory holds that Churchill somehow deliberately directed the ship into the path of U-boats to provoke an American reaction. In plain terms, that's false, but Churchill did most incautiously write to Walter Runciman, the president of the Board of Trade, that it is most important to attract neutral shipping to our shores, in the hope especially of embroiling the United States with Germany. We want the traffic, the more the better. And if some of it gets into trouble, better still, which was by any standards heartlessly cynical enough. So I guess one of the important things to remember when we have this kind of titanic figure of Winston Churchill, who has been, you know, in Great Britain raised to a point of almost kind of national reverence. You know, he's a figure around which, particularly in the last 20 years, almost kind of some slightly secular religion has been founded, and there's almost a kind of a secular worship of the two world wars. We have to see him as a kind of a realistic historical figure, you know, as a human being. Certainly his detractors on the left decry Churchill's imperialism and bigotry and racism. And if you look at the rhetoric that Churchill comes out with during the Second World War, particularly when it comes to the question of India, he says some absolutely dreadful things and takes some very racist positions. The real Churchill, just like the real anybody, exists as a kind of slightly unknowable character somewhere in the middle. Part of the kind of the adoration of Churchill is based in the realization that he had his flaws, and that he drank too much and smoked cigars and made outlandish, off the top of his head decisions. And the appeal is that, you know, as a result of this, he sort of somehow triumphed anyway, and it is part of kind of a British rejection of experts, intellectualism, and technocrats, that, you know, an aristocratic bluffer can do it, and that's what this country's all about. Well, you know, that's to ignore the fact that the aristocratic bluffer in question, as we've seen, was quite a cynical, calculating figure. In both world wars, he knew that the answer was to draw America in, and to rely on American support, and he was insistent that happen. There's a great deal to be said about Churchill's negotiations with Roosevelt during the Second World War. Churchill was very keen to make sure that supplies of munitions and other equipment got to Great Britain, but less keen to allow the power of American sort of hard and soft power to start supplanting the British Empire. And he was a very, very kind of canny negotiator at the Arcadia Conference in 1941 to prevent any concessions on eroding the currency and tariff walls around the British Empire. Although many Americans, writes Jeffrey Wheatcroft, were shocked by the Lusitania, there was still a very strong anti-war movement. "He kept us out of the war" was the slogan on which Wilson was re-elected in 1916, and he might have kept them out but for arrogant German folly. By proclaiming openly a campaign of unrestricted submarine warfare, and by secretly, but not secretly enough, urging Mexico to attack its northern neighbour, Germany finally provoked Wilson in April 1917 to proclaim that a state of war existed. In those distant days, when Congress had not supinely surrendered its fundamental constitutional rights to declare war, Wilson's request was debated at length on Capitol Hill before a declaration of war was passed on the 6th of April. Though far from unanimously, 82-6 in the Senate and 373-50 in the House. This decision was followed by the disastrous 1917 Nivelle Offensive, which was resulted in mutinies in the French army, which General Robert Nivelle crushed with firing squads. And the offensive led Churchill in the House to say, well, you know, we need to call an end to offensives with it, just throw men into the meat grinder and stop all that and wait for the Americans to come. Really just sit tight and wait for millions and millions and millions of American soldiers to land and to get ready. The Americans weren't really ready for about 9 or 10 months. The army of General John Pershing was only really able to get into any meaningful kind of combat shape in about the spring of 1918. And so it was a long waiting game. Churchill, by the summer of 1917, had been exonerated by the Dardanelles inquiry into the disaster of Gallipoli. And that meant that Lloyd George could bring him back into government. And remember, you've got this character that Lloyd George kind of liked. You know, the extent to which Lloyd George really had friends is debatable. But they were kind of political allies and contemporaries. But Lloyd George also saw him as a kind of a liability, somebody who you couldn't trust not to be in government with. But Churchill would have a kind of like a variety over the next few years of sort of portfolio positions and of ministerial portfolios, and he would be somebody who would hold most of the great offices of state long before his prime ministerial career began, and you know, in between time there would be this long period of political wilderness. So Winston Churchill is this curious figure during the First World War, of both somebody who, if you look objectively at his resume, should have had very little role in anything at all. His time as First Lord of the Admiralty is one that is punctuated by failure. He seems to be out of step with what most of the generals and certainly what the Prime Minister is saying. He has political enemies in both parties, and he's seen as kind of unreliable and untrustworthy. He is in many ways the complete opposite of Herbert Asquith, who Asquith's running of the war, again, is quite a strange affair. He's kind of lackluster and disinterested, and seemingly kind of unable to attend war cabinet meetings, and his part of the reason here is perhaps Asquith's temperament, of his belief in liberal values of individual liberty that kind of came that stood in contrast to things like the Defence of the Realm Act, conscription, and the growth of the state, which, you know, the size of the state explodes during the First World War. And this is partly to do with his reluctance to introduce conscription, which was the wedge issue that Lloyd George and the press barons used to remove Asquith. So interesting and contrasting characters, Churchill, Asquith and Lloyd George. There we'll finish things. I hope you find this useful. I'm doing a few little shorts on YouTube at the moment for students. We're just going to do a few things on the New Deal, and I'll be doing another study extra pretty soon on Stalin and the power struggle to succeed Lenin. Thanks very much. Take good care. All the best. Bye bye. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.